the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grace of wrath was stored. He has loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory.
The Cutting Edge will be spending the next 2 weeks exploring the lives and works of the 2012 Annisfield Wolf Award winners. First up is David Blight, 2012 winner for nonfiction for his work American Oracle, The Civil War in the Civil Rights Era. He's also working on a biography of Frederick Douglass to be released next year. He is, as to be expected from his body of work, one of the nation's most preeminent scholars on the Civil War. His course at Yale, The Civil War and the Reconstruction Era, 1865 to 1877, is available for free on Yale's Open Course website. His work has been acknowledged by many, as his long list of awards and accolades can prove. He's won the Frederick Douglass Prize, the Lincoln Prize, the Merle Curdy Award, the James A. Rowley Prize, the Bancroft Prize, and now an Annisfield Wolf Book Award. The awards are the only national jury literary competition devoted to recognizing books that have made an important contribution to society's understanding of racism and the diversity of human cultures, and will be presented on September 13th in Cleveland, Ohio. Henry Louis Gates, director of the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African American Research at Harvard University, served as jury chair for the awards. David, welcome. First, the obligatory question. Why did you write this book, and who or what is the oracle mentioned in the book's title?
Well, I wrote this book because I wanted to have a book that had something to say out there at this time we're living through of the 150th anniversary of both the Civil War and Emancipation. And I also wanted to write something about the way in which Emancipation and the Civil War were remembered during the 100th anniversary season, which was the late 1950s and into the 1960s. I also wrote it because these are four authors that I had always wanted to write something about, actually five authors. And the title, American Oracle, actually comes from a quotation from Robert Penn Warren. It's in his wonderful little book he published in 1961 called The Legacy of the Civil War, in which he says, "The Civil War draws this as an oracle, darkly unriddled and portentous of national and personal fate." And I think Warren had a point. I do think the Civil War period and the emancipation of 4 million slaves is a kind of an oracle-like event in our history. We return to it. We go to it. It informs us. We try to get wisdom from it. We don't always manage that. Exactly where physically that oracle might be located is another matter. But that's where the title comes from. And as I said, these authors, Warren, James Baldwin, Bruce Catton, Edmund Wilson, and Ralph Ellison, were all extremely important writers during the 1950s and 60s at this moment of the Civil War centennial. And I thought by looking closely at their work, we might have a template to understand where we are today.
Well, David, in your prologue, you mentioned the I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther King. Yes. And the connection he made to the Gettysburg Address. Tell us about that connection.
Yes, well, everyone now grows up, I mean, every child in America grows up probably knowing something about the I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther King, which he gave on August 28th, 1963 at the Lincoln Memorial. But we tend to only remember the last 3 or 4 minutes of it, which is where King broke from his script and went into that beautiful poetry about the dream metaphor. But the first 13 to 14 minutes of that speech were a scripted lecture of a kind that is all about the centennial of emancipation and the centennial of the Civil War. He opens in the first paragraph by saying, 100 years ago, he uses that refrain five times, 100 years ago, 100 years ago, 100 years ago. And he says, you know, I'm standing in the shadow of a great American, Lincoln behind him. And he says at the end of each of those refrains, and the Negro is not free, and the Negro is not yet free. And from there he moves into other kinds of metaphors in that speech, like the promissory note, which he says has come back labeled insufficient funds in the Bank of American Justice. There he's actually referring to the Declaration of Independence and its first principles. And then he is also obviously directly referring to the Gettysburg Address, because he begins the speech by referring to 50 years ago, meaning 100 instead of the 40 that Lincoln had used at the opening of the Gettysburg Address. So it's King's brilliant poetic appeal to this moment in American history, when the country was going through this 100th anniversary of the Civil War, with great fanfare and lots of public attention and a national commission, but paying so little attention, so little serious attention to the 100th anniversary of emancipation, at the very time the country was obviously undergoing the Civil Rights Revolution, which had brought those 200 or 300,000 people to the mall to protest and demand, in effect, an Equal Rights Amendment. It's also rooted in something that most Americans still know nothing about, and that is that right after President Kennedy was inaugurated in 1961, Martin Luther King and SCLC in the South began to lobby the Kennedy White House to issue a second Emancipation Proclamation, and that's exactly what they called it. They began lobbying the Kennedy White House as early as January and February 1961. They continued it through the following year, and in the spring, actually May 17th, 1962, Martin Luther King held a special news conference and issued a 60-some page document, a manifesto of a kind, that they delivered to the White House, asking the president to write and deliver a second Emancipation Proclamation. It's a remarkable document. It's mostly a legal brief prepared by King's lawyers. In fact, the key lawyer who did it is still alive. His name is Clarence Jones. He lives out in Palo Alto, California. The March on Washington and the Dream Speech of 1963 is rooted in, by then, 2 years. More than 2 years of lobbying in all kinds of ways the White House to move on civil rights. Now, the reason for that in part is because at that time, say in 1961 or 62, the leaders of the civil rights movement had very little reason to believe that they were ever going to get real change out of the U.S. Congress, because the Congress was still dominated by Southern Democrats, segregationists. Their hope was to appeal to the executive branch, just like was done in the Civil War. And hence the appeal for a second Emancipation Proclamation. In the wake of Kennedy's death, of course, his assassination in November of 63, and the advent of Lyndon Johnson in the presidency, it turned out differently. It turned out that we did get the 64 Civil Rights Act before the end of 1964. But that moment of the 100th anniversary is of emancipation and the Civil War, the two of them together, is just an extraordinary moment when you think about the country having a Civil War centennial, when they tended to celebrate almost nothing but the kind of blue and gray valor of both sides. At the same time, you're having the Civil Rights Movement. And so I use that moment and that event as a way to open the book, and the whole introduction is really about that. And then I move into a deeper analysis of these four authors.
It is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hoped that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual.
Just out of curiosity, what were the real causes of the Civil War? Was it economic, or was it a question of states' rights, which is an issue that lingers even to this day? Do these remain solved or unanswered, or what?
Well, they are not entirely solved, and they are not entirely answered. And yes, the idea that the Civil War is rooted only in states' rights is a notion you simply cannot kill. Last year, in the spring of 2011, at the 150th anniversary of Fort Sumter, I believe it was CNN that ran a poll. It said that something like 48% of Americans did believe that slavery was the principal cause of the Civil War, but that about 52% did not believe it was the principal cause of the Civil War, and other things were. Now, you know, to each person to decide whether that's progress or not. Yes, of course, the Civil War is rooted to some degree in states' rights doctrine. Does a state or any locality have the right to resist certain federal legislation? Are certain powers reserved to the states? Well, sure, under the Constitution. But for a half century now and more, in scholarship and to some degree in schooling and textbook writing and the rest, we as a profession among historians have demonstrated unequivocally to any reasonable person's satisfaction that without the institution of slavery, and especially its expansion and its tremendous wealth that it had created in the South by the 1850s, without the problem of slavery in America's future, there would never have been a Civil War. And all one really needs to do to understand that reality is just go to the secession crisis as one place to start. Just go look at the secession conventions. When the 11 states of the South seceded from the Union, the first seven seceding before Lincoln was inaugurated, and then the next four seceding after Fort Sumter, just go to their secession conventions, look at their resolutions, read their resolutions. All of them say unequivocally that they are seceding to save, preserve a racial order, that they are seceding to preserve the slave system, that they are seceding to preserve their way of life, and on and on and on. It's unequivocal. There's no question about it. Jefferson Davis said it. Alexander H. Stephens, his vice president, said it unequivocally. So we need only listen to the leaders of the Confederacy explaining why they were seceding from the Union to understand how important slavery was as a cause at its core. However, over time, in this 150 years since, so much energy, so much ink, so much in our cultural resources has gone into denying this, into deflecting this idea that slavery caused the Civil War. So much energy has gone into any other kind of set of causes, economic systems, tariffs, states' rights, expansionism, and so on. I mean, my own personal answer to everyone who always says, but wasn't it really about states' rights, is to say, sure, it's about states' rights, but whenever the issue of states' rights comes up, you have to ask, to what issue is it employed? States' rights for what? And in this case, it was states, an exercise of states' rights, if you want to call it that, the act of secession to preserve a slave society. Now, to your point or your question about whether these issues have ever gone away, no, they have not. And all one needs to do today is to look around. Look at our Supreme Court, which is the most states' rights Supreme Court we've had in a half a century. Look out in state legislatures. There are hundreds of bills before state legislatures in the United States right now, particularly those controlled by the Republican Party, all designed to take power from the federal government and remove it back to the states. Sometimes that has to do with equal protection issues. Sometimes it has to do with environmental protection issues. Sometimes it has to do with endangered species matters. Sometimes it has to do with the Commerce Clause. But it also has a lot to do now with voting, doesn't it? With all these voter ID laws being passed by state legislatures, because states do control the process of voting within their states. What we really need in this country on issues of voting is a federal voting law, so that these voter ID attempts to suppress the vote are simply not possible.
Let's talk about Reconstruction. What were its triumphs and its failures that led to the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1877?
Well, Reconstruction is that decade and a half of American history, from the end of the Civil War to at least 1877, when a second American Republic was really born and invented out of the imperatives of the emancipation of 4 million slaves, the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, and the 15th Amendment. The first Civil Rights Acts, the one passed in 1866, and a later one passed in 1874. Sometimes this is referred to as Radical Reconstruction or the Radical Reconstruction regime of the immediate post-Civil War Republican Party. We got the Equal Protection Clause and the 14th Amendment out of this. We got birthright citizenship out of the 14th Amendment and the Voting Rights Act of the 15th Amendment, the Voting Rights Amendment. However, as always happens in history, when you have such a revolution in law and in politics and in the social environment on the ground, liberation of 4 million people from slavery into some kind of newly defined free labor and some kind of level of civil and political rights, it inspired a counter-revolution. And that counter-revolution was enormously violent. It led to the evolution of the Ku Klux Klan by 1868 and its many imitators. It led to massive violence across the South to suppress, to destroy, in effect, the Republican Party in Southern states. It led to this process that history calls Southern Redemption, which was the attempt of white Southern Democrats to return their states after they were readmitted to the Union to white the rule of white supremacy. That's precisely what they were trying to reestablish, such that by 1876, there were only three states left that hadn't been taken back over by the Southern Democratic Party. And in that disputed election, those final three South Carolina, Louisiana, and Florida were brought back under Democratic Party rule, and the Hayes-Tilden Compromise that made Hayes president but ended Reconstruction in effect on the ground and legally for good was put together in a kind of smoke-filled room deal in Washington, D.C. However, there are elements of Reconstruction that still continued, and debates, of course, about the issues of Reconstruction and the issues of the aftermath of emancipation and the issue of black civil and political rights, of course, went on and on and on for generations. In some ways, Reconstruction never really ended until 100 years later.
David, let me ask you.
What some people have referred to as a second Reconstruction, which was the Civil Rights Movement.
David, let me ask you this. Of course, the 77 Compromise led to the deoccupation of the South,
right,
the rise of Jim Crow and entrenched legalized segregation.
Right.
Does reparations ever come into the conversation? Why isn't that a part of the conversation? And how do you view the post-Reconstruction era?
Well, reparations actually was part of the conversation.
40 Acres and a Mule, you mean?
Yeah, well, 40 Acres and a Mule is a kind of symbolic beginning of that argument. But there were bills, a couple at least, before the U.S. Congress, one in particular drafted by Thaddeus Stevens, one of the leaders of the Radical Republicans in 1866-67, which would have been a kind of redistribution of land to the freed people, including small amounts of money. That never passed. There were other attempts. Frederick Douglass had an idea that he kind of borrowed from Thaddeus Stevens and then remade it his own by 1868, which was something similar. A redistribution of land and some cash to the landless and cashless freed people who were still 99% agricultural laborers across the South. That never went anywhere either. There was, for a while, an organization started by and led by a woman named Callie House, an African-American woman, a former slave, and she and many others who helped her created an organization that was kind of a freed people's former slave reparation plan. They lobbied Congress, they lobbied legislatures, they tried to raise money. It didn't get anywhere either by the 1880s and 1890s. So that idea was always there in the late 19th century, during Reconstruction in the late 19th century. It just ran headlong into a deep American philosophy of laissez-faire government, of self-reliance and individualism, this idea that you would divide property and in any way redistribute it in the wake of such a revolution of like emancipation, was so antithetical to a kind of deep American self-definition, you know, that people weren't supposed to be given anything, they should have to work for it, and all of that. Another set of ideas.
Gee, that sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's another set of ideas we are living through once again in a virulent form today, with all this roiling individualism we keep hearing from.
Well, David, you know, before we get into the individual writers, and you chose five writers, Robert Penn Warren, Bruce Catton,
yeah,
Edmund Lewis, Ralph Ellison, and James Baldwin, to illustrate what you call the gulf between remembrance and reality. Tell us about the creation of that gulf and whether it is a local phenomenon or is it universal?
Well, gulf between, reality or history, if you want, and the way that public memories are formed are always there. There's always that gulf. Historical memory, public memory, is always about who gets to control it, who gets to write it, who gets to control it, who gets to control the museums, who gets to control the public rhetoric, the political rhetoric, and so on. I chose to work on these particular writers because they all, in their own very different ways and with their very different backgrounds, were trying to argue in nonfiction, in fiction, and in, to some degree even in poetry, they were trying to argue that Americans had ceased to understand their Civil War, that they had ceased to face squarely, both on the one hand, the terrible destruction of that war, the deeply tragic character of that war, when a nation divides and then engages in this level of bloodletting, tears itself to pieces and has to put itself...
Now, David, couldn't that go even further back? I mean, as far as the foundation of the country is concerned, and the institution of slavery, where many of the, our forefathers were slave owners.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it isn't... Yeah, sure. You have to go back before the Civil War to really grasp how we have or have not faced this part of our past. The founding fathers were, to some degree, dominated by slaveholders and the protection of slavery, and hence the various kinds of complicity in the U.S. Constitution. In order to get the U.S. Constitution agreed on by 1789, there had to be a whole variety of those famous compromises within the Constitution, the Three-Fifths Compromise being the most infamous. So sure, it clearly goes back to our richly ironic, paradoxical founding with someone like Jefferson, a very prominent slaveholder, being the author of those four first principles in the Declaration of Independence. America is born in that kind of bitter contradiction to begin with. Now, that bitter contradiction sowed the seeds, to put it in its simplest terms, of a bigger and later conflict. That's what Lincoln's saying when he says, fourscore and 7 years ago, in the Gettysburg Address, he's saying, this republic was born, but it had a problem. And here we are in the middle of this horrible war to decide whether that republic can endure. And basically what Lincoln said in the Gettysburg Address is that no, it could not, that the first republic was being destroyed and a second new one had to be invented. Now, Lincoln didn't have a perfectly clear idea of the course that would take, but he knew a new one had to be invented. Now, but in our memory, our national collective historical memory, Americans have never been comfortable with this idea that we were a slaveholding republic. We were a slaveholding nation. We were a pro-slavery nation for 80-some years. And because we were a pro-slavery nation, we had to end up in a horrible conflict, division, disunion, and war to determine whether that kind of republic or nation could exist in the future or not. And then, in its wake, in the wake of the bloodletting of the Civil War that slaughtered so many hundreds of thousands of people, we've tended to clean it up and sanitize it. We want it to be a glorious kind of experience, for both sides. And to put it, in blunt, simple terms, the nation's historical memory of the Civil War by its 100th anniversary, when these four writers were writing, basically argued that that the problem was over. Slavery may have had a role in this, but the country solved it. It fought a glorious war to destroy it, and it just got greater and better for having experienced it. The problem, of course, was that we didn't just get greater for having experienced. We invented the Jim Crow system by the 1890s.
And we didn't solve it.
No, we didn't solve it. And that had lasted, of course, another half century and more. By the time we were beginning to quote-unquote, celebrate the Civil War by the late 1950s and early 1960s. It's very hard for people today to truly grasp how dominant the Southern Confederate loss cause version of the Civil War had become by that event's 100th anniversary. The loss cause had become an almost national phenomenon. In fact, the lost cause, so-called, about the Confederacy was eventually not about loss at all. Their story was about the victory over Reconstruction, not the loss or defeat in the Civil War.
And you're listening to the 2012 Annisfield Wolf Award winner, David Blight, author of American Oracle, The Civil War in the Civil Rights Era. I'm Dred Scott Keyes. David, can you tell us the benefits of each of the writers that you have highlighted in your book, Warren, Caton, Wilson, Ellison, and Baldwin, and what they brought to your analysis of what has occurred in American society?
Yes, well, Robert Penn Warren was born in the South, Guthrie, Kentucky. He grew up deeply imbued with the Lost Cause tradition. He learned it from his grandfather, who'd been a Confederate cavalryman with Nathan Bedford Forrest. He spent his writing life trying to overcome how steeped he had been originally in that Lost Cause tradition, and I think he overcame it remarkably well. His greatest book is All the King's Men, one of the greatest novels of the 20th century, which is many things, but it's also a great Civil War novel. But Warren, the white Southern writer, also lived to write such books as Legacy of the Civil War, 1961, and other works that were demanding that the country face its past with slavery and race, that it face the fact that this war had been all about slavery. Bruce Catton was a Northerner. He was a Yankee born up in a small town in Michigan who became eventually the most widely read, best-selling narrative historian the Civil War has ever had. He had more readers than anybody. He wrote 15 books in 22 years, from 1951 to about 1973. And in his books, though they were largely military history, and he kind of wrote a history that could please both sides, he nevertheless was arguing that Americans had to learn that the Civil War was an essentially tragic event, that it wasn't just a glorious adventure. And then in Edmund Wilson, we have the greatest literary critic of the 20th century. Wilson's great contribution to this story was a massive 800-page book he published in 1962 called Patriotic Gore, which was a literary history of the Civil War. And there had never been any book like this written before. There had never been a book that demonstrated with such deep appreciation how literary Americans were at the time of the Civil War and in its aftermath. And Wilson, too, was arguing in his own kind of cynical, bitter, anti-war way that Americans had to realize that their Civil War was not some glorious outing. It was a terrible Armageddon. And then James Baldwin, who in many ways is my favorite among this group and the one I enjoyed working on the most and I suspect learned the most from. Born in Harlem, oldest of nine kids, grows up in terrible poverty, but got a good education in those New York public schools, particularly DeWitt Clinton High School, where some teachers grabbed hold of him. I mean, this guy was writing plays and poetry and short stories before he ever left high school. He couldn't go to college because he didn't have any money. Went down to Greenwich Village, tried to become a writer, but eventually left the country and spent 9 years in France, where he did write his first three novels. But the part of James Baldwin's work that I focus on mostly was his nonfiction. He became in effect the great essayist of the civil rights movement, and I think one of the greatest writers of nonfiction of that entire era, the 50s, 60s, even the 70s. And his great collections of nonfiction essays, Nobody Knows My Name, The Fire Next Time, his most famous work published in 1963, and others, made him kind of the most widely read nonfiction commentator on the Civil Rights Revolution. And Baldwin, if anyone goes back to read Baldwin's essays, you will find in almost every one of them, he makes his subject, well, I mean, whatever the topic is, whether it's one of his travel pieces about the South or whether it's his piece on Faulkner or whatever it's on, he makes his subject the nature of American history and the problem of how Americans face their past, of how they have developed a historical memory, why they won't face slavery, racism, and so forth. He's in some ways the most poignant, powerful commentator the country had about why we don't face this past. And so what I tried to do in this book is study each of these writers carefully, closely. Each gets his own long essay. But I try to write what is in effect a critical appreciation of how they were using either fiction or nonfiction to engage American historical memory, to make Americans wake up, to face their past, and especially face this past of the Civil War, emancipation, and its aftermath. Baldwin said in an essay in 1962, one of my favorite lines by him, and he's so quotable, but he said, "Too often Americans use history or the past to cover up the sleeper, but never to wake him up." It's a beautiful definition of what too many Americans do with the past or what they want from the past. They want a past, they want a history that makes them feel good, makes them sleep at night, to use Baldwin's metaphor, but doesn't really wake them up. Baldwin was all about the business of waking people up about their own past.
Well, David, you said also, you said Ralph Ellison, but Ralph Ellison isn't part of those four writers we talked about.
Well, I used Ellison for the epilogue.
For the epilogue, and where does he fit in all of this?
Well, Ellison's great book, of course, was Invisible Man, and that came out in 1948, 49. It had been out long before this, well, a decade before the Civil War centennial. But the way I used Ellison is that he wrote a piece in 1965, a fascinating essay short story in 1965 called Tell It Like It Is, Baby. That was the title. And to make a long story short, what it is Ellison's recounting of a dream, or a nightmare, frankly, that he had way back in 1957 when he was in Rome. Ellison was in Rome at something called the American Academy, beginning to write his second major novel. And he had a terrible nightmare one night after going to sleep, he said, reading a book about tragedy. And the short version is it's a dream he had about being a small black boy in Oklahoma who falls down through history and suddenly finds himself in 1865 at the funeral of Abraham Lincoln. But it's a very, very different funeral than most people think of. It's a horrifying, nightmarish kind of funeral with a mob, a huge mob, drunken mob of people carrying a litter with a body on it, and the body, it turns out, is Lincoln's, but they start carving up Lincoln's body. They start mutilating him. And the little boy, who's Ralph, is forced to help carry the body. It's a horrifying dream that he kind of just lights up and recites. It's a brilliant piece. And the title actually comes from a letter he had received from an old friend of his back in Oklahoma, who writes to Ralph Ellison and says, "So Ralph, you're over there, you know, in Rome, high-flying writer that you are. Haven't you heard what's going on back here in this country? So why don't you tell it like it is, baby?" And that's where he gets his title. He wakes up from the dream and the peace, and what he's given us is this kind of reversal, this horrifying reversal of the death and burial of Abraham Lincoln. It's a total nightmare. And he spends the last two pages of that piece, or more than two pages, interpreting his own dream. And in effect, Ellison says, beware. Right when you think history has changed in your favor, and note when he published it. He didn't publish this thing. He sat on this idea for years. He didn't publish this until 1965. After the passage of the 64 Civil Rights Act, after the passage of the 65 Voting Rights Act, Ellison publishes this piece saying, you know, right when you think you've triumphed, watch out. Because that's when history may come right back and smack you. So I use that essay by Ellison to kind of work my own epilogue about, you know, beware when we think we've triumphed. Beware when you think history has turned in your favor. It might just be the moment when it's going to turn the other way again.
Of course, David, we're under the tyranny of the clock. And I know we mentioned in our intro that you would be, of course, writing a book about Frederick Douglass.
I am.
As a teaser, can you give us something that you found out about Douglass that is not widely known?
I'll do that. In fact, I just found it 2 weeks ago. I'm six chapters deep into a new biography of Douglass, and I went to New Bedford, Massachusetts a couple of weeks ago because I had received a tip. It turns out, and that's the town Douglass lived in right after he escaped from slavery in 1838 to 1841. He's between the ages of 21 and 23. One of the first things Douglass did in New Bedford, within a year, it appears, is he registered to vote. He was registered to vote by 1840, at least. He may have registered in 1839. What that meant in Massachusetts in 1839, 40, and 41 is that as a fugitive slave, highly, thoroughly illegal fugitive slave, now under an assumed name, as many people know, he changed his name from Frederick Bailey to Frederick Douglass. He has an assumed name. He has no legal identity. He is property of his owner still back in Massachusetts by law, but he went down to the courthouse and he paid the $1.50 that you had to pay in Massachusetts at that point to become registered to vote. It was a kind of poll tax, but that's how you got the right to vote. And he did it 2 years in a row. And I just find it interesting that the great Frederick Douglass was able to, in effect, kind of commit fraud. You know, he's an illegal alien. He's a fugitive slave in 1840 when he registers to vote. But he did register, and he did vote as a fugitive slave. And what fascinates me about that is to think about where we are now. With all these efforts to suppress people from voting because they don't have a government-issued ID, is interesting. Douglass had no government-issued ID. Nobody had a government-issued ID in the 19th century. But in effect, he was an illegal alien allowed to register to vote. That's my new fact of the last 2 weeks.
You know, and speaking on that, I mean, people have said that the whole suppression of the vote is, you know, a a solution looking for a problem, because as far as the voter fraud is concerned, there's no fraud and stuff.
It's absolutely clear what they're doing.
Mm. Well, David, I want to thank you for being over the air of Pacifica Radio in general, and of course, WBAI. David Blight is the author of American Oracle, The Civil War in the Civil Rights Era, and is published by Belknap Harvard. And again, he is the winner of the 2012 Hannesfield Wolf Award, which will be held on September 13th in Cleveland. Thank you much for your time.
Thank you, sir. I enjoyed it very much.
Look here, there's one more thing I got to say right here. Now, we're people, we like the birds and the bees. We'd rather die on our feet than keep living on our knees. Say it loud.
Essie Edgerton is a Canadian novelist born and raised in Calgary, Alberta, to Ghanaian parents. She studied creative writing at the University of Victoria and Johns Hopkins University before publishing her first novel in 2004, The Second Life of Samuel Tyne. She spent some time as writer-in-residence in Stuttgart, Germany, which inspired her to write another novel, Half-Blood Blues, about a mixed-race jazz musician who was abducted by the Nazis as a Rhineland bastard in World War II Europe. Published in 2011, Half-Blood Blues was announced as a shortlisted nominee for that year's Man Booker Prize, the Scotiabank Geller Prize, Rogers Writers Trust Fiction Prize, and Governor General's Award for English Language Fiction. She was one of two Canadian writers, alongside Patrick DeWitt, to make all four award lists in 2011. Last November, she won the Giller Prize for Half-Blood Blues. The book was also shortlisted for the 2012 Walter Scott Prize for Historical Fiction. In April, it was announced that Edgerton had won an Hannesfield Wolf Book Award for Half-Blood Blues. Essie, welcome. What prompted you to write this book? Was it your writer-in-residence experience in Stuttgart, in particular, or Germany in general, or something else?
I guess, you know, since the year 2006 until, I guess, last year, no, the year before last, I had been living on and off in, you know, various countries in Europe, but I spent most of my time, a little bit over a year, in the city of Stuttgart in the south of Germany, and I had a writer's residency there. So I was just working on a novel and taking German lessons and, you know, trying to really get a sense of German culture. And, you know, while I was there working on something completely different, I just started to wonder about the history of black people in Germany and ended up doing a bit of research and, you know, coming across just some fascinating pieces of history that I'd never encountered before, and then, you know, came very much to focus on this period of the Third Reich, and the novel just grew out of that.
How did you research the book?
Essentially, my research was, you know, I did take German lessons, but I would not say my German was at all strong enough to be reading, you know, scholarly German sources, and so, you know, I basically had, you know, English language resources to work from, of which, you know, when I was writing the book, it seemed like there were very few. But there are some, you know, the ones that are out there are just tremendous and wonderful. So, you know, there are just some terrific books on the subject. You know, Clarence Lussain, Hitler's Black Victims,
right.
Which is basically, you know, it doesn't just focus on the period of the Third Reich. You know, he kind of takes you through the, you know, that first encounter when you had African, you know, basically people coming over in a diplomatic capacity to Germany, which is very fascinating, you know, not something that you hear a lot about, you know, 18th century. There's a wonderful memoir, Hans Massakoi, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly. It was a memoir that was published some years ago, which was translated into the title was Growing Up Black in Nazi Germany, and that was the English title, which is quite different from the German title. You know, that was a really fascinating memoir of, I believe he was from Hamburg, and, you know, lived through the bombing of that city and just, you know, really fascinating stuff. So, yeah, there were quite a few written resources. And I also did, at some point, I was in touch with, you know, with a gentleman who had, who had, you know, who's Afro-German and who had survived this wartime period, and, you know, he's very old, and, you know, he was able to sort of, you know, tell me a little bit about his experiences, and it was really fascinating. So, yeah, I would say it was mainly written resources, as well as this this very lovely, lovely gentleman.
Essie, your story begins in Paris in 1940 with the Hot Time Swingers. Tell us about them and the main characters and how they ended up in Paris.
It does begin in Paris. It's 1940. You have, you know, some of the musicians from the Hot Time Swingers who are in that city. And basically, you know, they've been playing in Berlin, you know, for several years, had a great, you know, had a small period where they were doing very well. And, you know, obviously since the Third Reich had been ushered in, they were prohibited from playing in public. And so they were mostly playing for themselves. But this, you know, basically subsistence living, just no money. And so, you know, at this point, they were kind of trying to decide how to leave Germany, how to make that possible. And then a woman comes, and she makes them this offer, and, you know, they see it as, you know, as this way to sort of, you know, to be able to finally leave and maybe go to France. And the offer involves, you know, working with Louis Armstrong, who in the novel is, you know, is in that country, doing a bit of recording. So it's, you know, France represents just this great, you know, this great freedom for them, and this feeling of possibility when there's been so much darkness surrounding them for so long. So, yeah, it's all about, you know, how do we get there?
Speaking of how to get there, tell us about the creative process in writing the book. Tell us about that.
I'm somebody who writes very, you know, I always like to think I can do everything in one draft, and this doesn't happen. So this was a very, I guess if I look at it from a distance, all told it was maybe 2.5-3 years, but it felt very protracted, you know, when I was in the middle of it. So it was probably about 5 drafts from start to finish, over 2.5 years. Just, you know, and the first draft was very, very, very different and told through the lens of, you know, like a historian or a researcher who was trying to kind of sort out what had happened to this, you know, this this band who'd left this recording. And it was very kind of distant and very kind of cold. And you know, I gave it to somebody who reads all of my work, and he said, you know, this is terrifically, you know, there's a great story here, but it's terrifically boring. So can you kind of just, you know, just let loose, just, you know, allow yourself to play. So I went back into it, and, you know, this is when I thought I'd focus on Sidney Griffiths, who's the American bassist, as, you know, really focus on him as being at the center of the story, and his relationship with the young Afro-German trumpeter, Hieronymus Volk. And, you know, and kind of allow myself to play with writing it in his very voice, and tweaking the language so that it was representative of, you know, how they would have spoken and thought. And
that was more or less German slang?
It was mainly American slang with more like kind of German, trying to get at German sentence structure and trying to get at German more like sayings rather than slang. But a lot of, you know, Chicago slang, New Orleans slang, and kind of mixing it up and you know, trying to get at a flavor of how he specifically would have spoken or thought.
Some have said that Half Blood Blues is the story of music, race, love, and loyalty. Tell us about each of those attributes as it relates to the book.
Well, I think Half Blood Blues is essentially the story of the relationship between, you know, between these men who are in the band, who are very, very close-knit, and who are, you know, going through just a tremendously difficult time living in this very kind of dark, very oppressive society. And, you know, that's got to, obviously, you know, having to kind of go underground and basically having only each other for companionship. You know, these are terrifically close but terrifically fraught relationships. And so, of course, you have all of these, you know, there's a great deal of love, you know, that they share between each other. But then there's also a lot of, you know, there's frustration and there's jealousy and all of these sort of artistic tensions that are coming out, you know, as well as personal tensions, you know, when a woman gets thrown into the mix. And so, yeah, I would say it's you know, exploring the relationships between these men and, you know, what the kind of wartime pressures did to those relationships.
Of course, one of the things that happened in the book or in Germany was the disappearance of a certain individual. Tell us that story and how it related through the whole, because you go back or you come forward in history to, I guess, 1992. Tell us about what was that dynamic?
Sorry, the dynamic?
Between the views that the characters, I guess, Sid and Chip had in, you know, when the disappearance happened and the way they looked at it now that it was 1992.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're not quite sure when the story, you know, after we have the sort of kind of prologue that happens in Paris and, you know, the story opens onto it's Baltimore, it's 1992. And there's, you know, there's a lot of mystery there. They're not quite sure, you know, what happened to one of their friends and to Hieronymus, and basically trying to sort out what happened is all very shrouded in mystery. And but there's a lot of guilt there, you know, and you get the sense that, you know, as the book opens, that there's a lot of apprehension that Sid feels towards returning to Germany, because, you know, you just feel like there's something there that we're not being told. And so, you know, when they make this journey back and they start to kind of discover things about, you know, various members of the band that, you know, they hadn't previously known, it's really quite shocking. But, you know, it allows Sid to, you know, although it's, you know, on some level very painful and very, very surprising, you know, he kind of gets to have a little bit of, well, I would say that they all kind of have a little bit of redemption there. You don't know if that's a lasting redemption, if that's something where, you know, if we open the book and it's 1995, if everything will kind of still feel like, you know, like there was a reckoning that happened, but certainly in 1992, there's a sense of more of a sense of closure, more of a sense of redemption there.
Essie, what would you want people to take away from Half-Blood Blues?
I guess I would just like, just people to say that they, ultimately, that they enjoyed it. I always like to hear that. I think every writer likes to hear that. I also like it when people tell me that, you know, I learned something that I didn't, you know, I hadn't been previously aware of. I had no idea about this history, and you know, that gives me great pleasure. And I really like to hear it when people, you know, are talking about the characters and, you know, as though they were real people, because I feel like, as a fiction writer, that, for me anyway, my personal project is to try and create people who I feel, you know, that people can feel that they were real, and that they were close to, or that they despised, or, you know, but that they felt, in the end, real. So, yeah, I guess those are the things that I would really hope people to take away from the book.
Of course, as we're under the tyranny of the clock, and I just wanted to ask, what is next for Essie Edukin?
I think I'm kind of planning another novel. I haven't had a chance to get back to my desk. It's been a very busy year, But definitely, you know, in the next few months, I'm going to sit down and get back to work.
Essie Edgecan, of course, is Canadian, is the author of Half-Blood Blues, which is now available, and is the winner of the 2012 Annisfield Wolf Award.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on your show.
Next, we'll conclude our coverage of the Annisfield Wolf Awards for 2012 with interviews with David Livingston Smith, author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, and biographer Arnold Rampersad. I'm Dred Scott Keyes.